So I'm going to pretty much start, take off where Chris finished yesterday. I want to add one point to his list of things that we should do with code. And I will actually address population synthesis in the context. But Chris said verification, checking the code, checking the equations are right. So this is pretty much done safely within population synthesis. Equations are pretty simple. It's just, you know, sometimes somebody forgets, you know, plus or minus, or, if, you know, instead of using, you know, exponent of 0.91 uses 0.119, it's going to be disastrous. But, you know, since we actually do verification of code, and just recently Ilya group has redone all that I've done with my code, and we got pretty much the same result. So at least we know that on that part, you know, we some simple framework of physical, you know, model, we're doing equations right. So we've done verification. At least, at basically, no.
Okay, I don't want to talk too much, but they're using the same fitting formula, right? I mean, the same content.
Correct, but they, you know, let's say I coded those formulae myself, and they adopted them from somewhere else, and then that's a single evolutionary part, and then binary part is written separately. I wrote my part, they wrote their part. So it's kind of, you know, it's a good kind of check that you do at least your equations right.
And population synthesis is easier to do this kind of thing than a lot of, like, hydro, where there's lots of options. At some point, and I think we've done this with your code and a long time ago, where the differences in population synthesis are often the assumptions you make.
Yes, exactly. Then it's very simple to check. So this is actually, of course, physics is very simple, so you can question that. But let's leave that for later. So this is done. Then, of course, you go to validation. And right now, I wanted to use black holes, since they were discovered recently, to actually lead that argument. So, you know, we do have models that reproduce the LIGO observations, that not only reproduce the LIGO merger rates of those black holes, which are here, and they also reproduce the masses of those black holes. So we have models with some simple physics. Again, it's definitely not perfect, but we have models that reproduce both rates and masses, which are two basic parameters that LIGO gave us through O1 observational run. So we have that done. But how do you go from these two, okay, to actually identifying through physics? Because when you think about, let's say I take, you know, classical, I will go through models of binary evolution in a second, but forming black holes, but, you know, let's say you have a big parameter space within a given just one model of classical binary evolution, like Ed was doing always, you know, since Philip is doing, I'm doing, you know. We have huge parameter space. We calculate few models in that parameter space. This doesn't reproduce LIGO, this doesn't reproduce LIGO, this doesn't. Oh, bam, this one does. Okay, and then we stop here, usually. Bam, you're done. You validated model. You validated that by definition, Chris' definition, that validation of your model. But it doesn't tell you that this is true physics at all. It could be gazillion of models here that do the same thing. We just don't know that. Okay? So we need to keep that in mind. So nobody has. So pretty much to actually within one given channel, formation channel, we have to sample entire parameter space and, you know, identify those degeneracies. So that has not been done yet with population synthesis. Ilya will be trying to do that with some kind of fancy statistical tools. I'm doing a brute force. We have a public public support from Poland in US and thousands of people calculating those models for us. So we don't want to do statistics, we just go brute force, because we have that force for free. We don't even pay for computer time. People, it's that Boeing platform that people, you know, supply us with. We give them Star Trek and they just calculate the data on their smartphones and computers. So we also use the smartphones.
In terms of your wonderful check mark on validation, congratulations very much. I just finished that test.
This is a very basic model.
And it's, my question is, for black hole level formation channels, you may have nailed it. Okay. But for doing more general population synthesis, the validation step is really more challenging. There are lots and lots of things to test against.
Fully. So the most embarrassing test in context of black holes, I think Philip would agree with me, would be we cannot reproduce the population synthesis, the galactic population of low-mass X-ray binaries with black holes. There's about 19 of them. The donor mass are about 0.6 solar mass. That's a peak. We cannot do it.
So it's qualified.
Yeah. So this, yes. So I'm just saying that, you know, in that particular, so that validation with one particular observation, but then there's other things. Yeah. Okay, in that context of those massive stars, we have some checks. Like we go through a phase of high mass X-ray binaries. So we do reproduce those, and we actually see those phases. Okay? We So, but some, there is a lot of problems left, for sure. So when you do all those models, so that's also actually getting to this. So when you find a bunch of models that can reproduce the same observations, you ask which ones are true.
And then you... solar mass red supergiants.
Say it again?
We are the 80 solar mass red supergiants.
In a galaxy with 1/10 of the metallicity,
yeah.
That is not
That is not... And you know, and most of them, let's say, they got the envelope removed by mass transfer early on, so they don't expand that much. Okay, because they're in closed binaries. You want them?
We see some.
You want them in closed binaries?
Right?
So
red supergiants.
Red supergiants. Yeah. Oh, okay.
I agree with you that they might be difficult to see because they're not in our galaxy.
Yes.
But certainly in our galaxy we don't see them.
But I also would think that, you know, since all those massive stars are in binaries, and if there are most of them in closed binaries, you lose those envelopes, so they never expand to those...
But we see the 40 solar mass red supergiants.
There's a more subtle reason now, right? So for the... below a certain metallicity, the expansion is very late, right? So it doesn't last very long. So the KC red supergiants just don't spend very long there. It's thousands of years.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, that's another metallicity effect.
Sure, but you don't see the equivalent objects in the local universe.
No. But if they literally spend 1,000 years there...
Sure. No, I agree with that. Yeah.
And let's say if this is a problem, then you just kill the channel entirely.
But also is a question.
Yes, but let me just think that if this is true, you just kill the channel entirely and go to the other channels, which will be my next step, okay?
Sure.
Yeah. Who has a question? Sorry, Norbert.
No, yeah, so I'm also a bit surprised about the validation check. So, in binary evolution, we have various discrete phases where things happen. You know, if you look at a van den Heuvel plot, then you can see all these steps.
Mm-hmm.
Proper validation for me would be if all these steps are validated. All these steps are validated one by one.
Yeah. So let me go.
I would propose to start at the first one. So can you reproduce?
Is it my sequence? That's right. The starting point. That's a very first point. Which I'm gonna which I'm gonna go to. Which I'm gonna go to.
But you know, the first stage.
Is a Rochelle overflow.
After the first binary interaction.
Yes.
Can you reproduce the massive algal binaries? Can you reproduce the distribution of nitrogen abundances in the main sequence stars? For example.
Mm-hmm.
If that would fail, all the rest would be...
Sure, I'm totally with you on that. So I just said that within a very simple input physics that we have for a given model, that validation was for one observation. And then you do have number of steps. And for this particular channel, because there are other channels as well, but for this particular classical binary evolution to do double black holes, you have first Rochelle overflow. You need to such sufficient conditions. Stable. We do see massive binaries exchanging mass. Then you have... What do you mean? But what do you mean reproduce them?
Well, there's various well-observed massive binaries. You could check whether any of them is in your...
Oh, no, definitely not, because then we wouldn't be sitting here because astrophysics would be solved. And we're here we have a problem.
So the validation really means all the phases.
Yes. Yes. So let's put it...
You're almost never done validating, so...
No. Norbert. I must have introduced confusion here. I didn't mean that we validated everything. I just meant that we went at that one observation. We have a couple of checks in place. Let's say a step before forming a high mass X-ray binary, a black hole and a Wolf-Rayet star, that we see, and we see them both in van den Heuvel in Ed's diagram, type of diagram in our evolution, and we see them on sky. Okay? So we have a step before.
Do you produce the right numbers?
We do. Mm-hmm.
Sigma 6-3, one in our...
No, those are low mass. I'm saying IC10.
Sigma 6-3.
Sigma 6-3...
It's a high mass system.
No.
Produced.
No. What's the mass of the companion in Sigma 6-3?
You have written papers on Sigma 6-3.
Yes, so that's a low mass for me. That's not high mass. It's not a 20 or 50.
I think we know nothing about the mass, and I see...
Yes, exactly. So
it's probably a high mass black hole. 10 solar mass black hole.
Okay, I think it would be 3 solar mass black hole, 5 solar mass black hole, yeah.
I
don't think we know masses.
But still, that type of system.
Okay, so no, I then don't...
There's only one in our
galaxy. Okay, yeah. But guys...
That's the point.
No,
that's the point.
And I'm with you on that, that yes, we don't know those things, and I'm definitely not claiming otherwise. I'm just saying that with that simple physics, that validation only refers to reproducing that one observation. That one, that's it.
So you've done one validation.
Exactly, that's what, so yes, so maybe it was, that's okay. Is that good, or should I just take it off?
I have a comment also to that step, because, you know, what I'm wondering, if you choose randomly two masses of compact objects at the end of the evolution, you know, like you would have observed something completely different. Would you be able to explain that as well? Is your method able to say, well, certain things we are not able to reproduce, because only then I would consider this a validation at all, because if you can reproduce everything, whatever would be observed, then this is not a validation.
No, I'm not able to. Let's say if mass ratios of those black holes were all like extreme, that wouldn't point to our models. And not only my models or Ilya's models, they would exclude those models, they would exclude those models, would leave some other ones.
Which mass ratio?
I'm talking about mass ratio of black holes. So they are pretty close to one.
So which mass ratios could you?
So below 0.5, it's very hard.
But you could do it if you wanted.
Not really. Below 0.3, that would be almost impossible. I don't know how to do it.
Why would that be?
Okay, that's a long distance.
That's just black hole formation.
That's just black hole formation. You exchange your mass in certain way, and that's a totally different subject. I would have to actually pull out my laptop and get those evolutionary channels on the blackboard.
You would have to ask for power in this validation step if you can really prove that you cannot reproduce any random combination.
No, I'm saying to you, I cannot do that. I cannot do it because we haven't checked the parameter space. So I'm with you on that. I'm only saying validation in a sense of Chris' definition, that you have a code, and you have one observation, and you have reproduced with one observation. So all the critical comments that you have, I'm behind you on that. Sure.
The issue is, I think if you say that your model needs to be falsifiable, otherwise there's no validation.
Yes, of course.
But, so if you had mass ratios of 0.3, say, yeah? Mm-hmm. If that was the observation, and three of them, would you then have gotten the wrong rates?
I would get very wrong rates. My rates would be way, way too low, way below one, way below.
In that case, I think it is a validation, but it's just one step.
Exactly, but one step, and I'm saying...
It recognizes the importance of doing it.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. We're not done, we're not even close to being done, I'm only discussing one very simple model. And it's not only me, it's like, you know, we put all the information that we pretty much, not all the information, but the information that we're able to grab from you guys doing single evolution or binary evolution, you know, studying, you know, supernovae, mass transfer, into simple models to get simple estimates. It was order of magnitude estimates. I wouldn't bother about a factor of 2 or 5, order of magnitude. And for me, it's surprising that with all the uncertainties that you guys bring up, that we even are able to find one model that reproduces, in that sense it's a validation, that reproduces those three detections. I was really surprised myself that we do. I would just expect, and I thought I would be, okay, I would go at for years at cranking those knobs, checking parameter space, trying to find that one model that does that one single validation. No, we had this ready before even observations.
But you did reject quite a few models.
No, we didn't. Actually, we only rejected like two models. Okay. We did six models, okay. And they were done before like observations. And one of them, which was our standard model, seemed to actually give both the numbers and the masses.
At least some of them failed.
But some of them failed, yes. We overdone with common envelope, we overdone with black hole natal kicks, so those were rejected. But we've done only like six of them. But it was a huge parameter space that could help us to discern between those different things, which hasn't been done in any of those models, not only classical.
But I don't understand why you're surprised that you can reproduce it, because we know that you have very, very sensitive parameters. The rates can be tuned by a factor of 1,000 or more, depending on what you do.
Mm-mm, mm-mm. Well, that's not true.
No.
That's a wrong notion that people keep repeating over and over years. No, but you can publish hydro codes from 20 years ago and now and say that the results differ. This is not the way to compare the codes. When you look at LIGO paper, let's say that Ilya, the 2010 paper with LIGO rays that differ by 3-4 orders of magnitude. Those are codes. Let's say some codes don't have winds, stellar winds at all. So why would you even include that in your range of models? This, you know up front that this is untrue. If you go to realistic assumptions that you would agree with, actually, I think, if I showed you those assumptions, those rates will only change maybe by order of magnitude, maximum by 2, but not like 4 orders or 3 orders of magnitude. So when you compare population versus code, you're usually comparing the lack of knowledge, the different levels of lack of knowledge. And you know, if you compare, you know, results from 10, 20 years ago, when people get zero black holes, like Donovan Beveren or, you know, Heiss, and they're just redoing the calculations right now, they're just updating the physics.
Maybe we should rediscuss that after we talk about the physics which goes into that.
Yeah. So physics, so exactly. So I don't want you to talk about physics, because I wanted to lead you through a logical structure, how we can actually get to even, because we haven't even started identifying through physics, through population synthesis. This is, so my initial statement is that population synthesis is not a thing to come up with with input physics, it's just to provide a simple order of magnitude test for proposals from your community. That's it. And if it's used wisely with all those caveats that I'm going to discuss, that we're already discussing.
You were not here, I believe, when we discussed common envelope and evolution of massive stars, but we concluded here that there's no predictive power in any model of common envelope evolution of massive stars.
Yeah, so let me get at this.
Okay, the time's not here.
Yes, but again, I would...
Sure.
Again, I would have a contradicting view, at least with my perspective. We know that common envelope somehow works. Forget the models right now. We know that somehow pre-CVs, you see hundreds of pre-CVs.
Yeah, no
wait a second. You see also intermediate mass stars because you see those red dwarf nuggets right now, things going into common envelope, okay? You see a binary orbit shrinking, Ogle data, and it goes common. So you start seeing them. Some of them are 5-7 masses. Sure, you don't see 100 or 80. I'm with you on that. It's a short-lived phase. Sooner or later, we'll see them. Okay? But the thing is, those things are happening. You see I believe what it is, you see the outcome of a massive common envelope, which is, no matter what you believe, what sits in IC10 X1 or NGC 300 X1, and there's a third one, massive Wolf-Rayet star, 20, 30 solar masses, and a compact object on a one-day orbital period. How would you like to make that without common envelope? Massive common envelope? I don't know.
Evolution.
What?
Homogeneous evolution. You can make it.
Okay. Then you take this model out and move to this one. Sure.
Oh, it's not. Doesn't mean that the new model is wrong. It just means that it's another way.
But yeah, but that's perfect. That's perfect. You're just bringing that up. But I think actually the common evolution works even for massive stars. And you just pointed out to me caveats. If you want to do this homogeneous, fine. Then I don't have observational data. But then when you go to modeling, I think actually modeling. Why actually having a proper model is not important for our predictions? Look, imagine you have that orbital period. Initial orbital periods are pretty wide. I mean, they cover a pretty wide range, from less than a day to thousands of days. So when you do classical evolution with some alpha lambda prescription, okay? I understand it's wrong. It probably doesn't work like this. But you pick your progenitors of double black holes from that range. Then you change your alpha lambda. Let's say forget even alpha lambda. You say that common envelope is less efficient than less efficient in tightening the binary, so you need to start in a different part of parameter space. Or if it's more efficient, from here. You have a lot of binaries, a wide range of initial separation to bring them together.
It's the other way around.
Oh, other way around, yes, sure. Sure, exactly. But the thing is, you would have to do something really crazy to go out of the ranges that are covered by stars. So I don't really care about that. I mean, I do care about that. I would like to have a proper model for common envelope, but whether it's slightly more effective, slightly less effective, it still should work.
There's a fundamental difference if you go to those stars which produce 20, 30 solar mass black holes, because you get to the Eddington limit and...
you approach Eddington limit. You don't go to Eddington limit.
You exceed the Eddington limit.
Well, you guys were saying, but you're talking about the envelope expansion.
For example, there's other possibilities too. So, you know, there is fundamental changes there in the stellar physics, and I think we have no evidence at all what common envelope evolution does for this.
Okay, and your point is?
That you have a lot of freedom in theoretical modeling of population.
Yes, I fully agreed.
But you also still have this problem if you just would eliminate the most massive black holes. I mean, if you go to the lower masses, I think things would work, I suppose. I mean, you will not have the energy limit, so...
If you go to double neutron star systems, I would argue that you probably need common envelope evolution there.
Yeah.
But all what's on the blackboard, I'm not sure.
But I'm with you. We have big problems, and that's what I'm getting at. For a given, which I said up front, for a given simple model that was verified in terms of equations, and this very simplistic one, you can validate the observations. That's still true. That one observation from LIGO, three observations, but one run, with all the caveats that are not covered. So that's what we haven't gotten to. This is exactly what I wanted to stress out, identifying true physics. So we need to... Not only for that framework, you still need to cover full parameter space to come up with the conclusions, and will be covered that you may not your models, your underlying models, let's say for common envelope, are not right, and we don't have better ones. So, in that sense, I think as a community we will come up with a better model. Philip said about 5 years from now we will have something better.
That
will And then we'll just pretty much put it in and start repeating the process. But the process will be the same. We'll need to verify, validate that we observe, and then still cover parameter space to see if with this model we can reproduce reality and how degenerate our solutions are. It will be still the same process. And that's only within one channel. So that brings me to next important point. That, let's say we get some within a model limitation, whether it's in 5 years or right now, we get a set of conclusions. Let's say we need to forget at low metallicity. We need to go for common envelope or don't go for common envelope. Or need to do this. So we have some implications. But as long as we don't know that those observations are coming from this channel, those implications are not valid. Because you first need to... Because there will be, let's say, three implications here, two here on physics. Will be, let's say... Five here. Well, I'll go through those models in a second. Each of them are different. And each of them can reproduce part or all of them, all of those observations. So you have implications within a given model, with given information channel. But you learn nothing unless you know where those black holes are coming from which one. And at the moment, we have no way of knowing which channel they came from. So you may have your conclusions in each channel, but we haven't learned anything yet. Again, I think, despite what LIGO people are saying, I think it will be damn difficult to tell where those black holes are coming from. So models. Classical binary channel I don't have to cover. Homogeneous rotation channel I don't need to cover in that room. Dynamics I don't have to cover. But here, Chris already mentioned AGNs. So there are two channels informing those double black holes in AGNs. One is you have a massive, dense disk around central black hole, and you form stars, and they can make a binary black hole, and then the friction provided by the disk will make them merge. But also, in AGN, you have a nuclear clusters, dense clusters of stars around the central black hole, and people think that you can actually get double black hole mergers from those. And then there is idea that you could actually identify those. Those would be the easiest to identify, because Virgo is not working right now, but when we have LIGO India or Kagra in Japan, you will be able to localize which part of the sky it came from and look for AGNs, which are bright. And you won't do that, I mean, localization won't be that great, but if you have a redshift from double black hole measurement, and if you have, let's say, population of double black holes, and if you can actually try to study statistically, if you always see an AGN in the big field, let's say 20 square degrees at a given redshift, they come all from that channel. And this is the only one, as I believe, that can produce black holes that are ejected at such a high speed that you can actually you may be able to see a phase shift of gravitational wave. Global clusters eject double black holes as well, but not at speeds high enough. Those could be ejected at such a high speed when they merge, you will see a shift. So they could be identified, but otherwise are very degenerate. Okay?
I understand how the disk channel would divide those mergers have to happen where there's an AGN, but why for the nuclear cluster? Couldn't there be a nuclear cluster without an AGN?
Could be. You just need a massive object to bring a cluster of stars and disrupt it around the massive object. So it doesn't have to be AGN, it's just massive black hole.
So most galaxies don't have AGN that are active, but they do have nuclear clusters.
Okay, so that may be, I may have named it wrong. Because, yeah, I don't work on the channel, so let's say yes.
Are the grade estimates not very low for the AGN channel?
Those estimates are all over the place. They really have no data on those channels. This is pretty much an idea that was put out a few months ago. A few months or several months ago, I don't know, last year. And there's really hand-wavy estimates, so I don't know those estimates. But they, of course, all those channels pretty much claim that, you know, it could happen that you can produce those black holes, the giveaway.
Yeah, I mean, within their error bars, they can, if they choose optimistic values, they can get a rate that's high enough.
Yeah.
My fear with those is that if you are at all not optimistic on any of those, you start to get below the rate you need. So I think detailed calculations is going to make the rate too low, but it has to be done if they really want to sell.
Can they produce 70 solar mass black holes? That would be a prediction.
I don't know about multiple mergers, because you would need multiple mergers for that. Global clusters, that's what people are betting on, that if you see 70 solar mass black holes, they will come from here. Or in with mass less probability from dynamical clusters. When you produce double black hole from global, when you have a double black hole merger in global cluster, that merger pretty much gets ejected. So it has only a small chance to catch another black hole and then merge again. So it's hard to produce over massive black holes that way, because you would need multiple mergers. They're hard to make.
So why can't you get it from homogeneous rotation? Why can't you get a 200 solar mass black hole?
You have perinstability supernova problem in every of those channels with star evolution. So perinstability will produce a second mass gap for black holes.
Above that then? 300
solar masses? No, that's a second mass gap. So it goes from about 50, 70 to about 130, 150. So you have a second mass gap. Okay? So you don't really expect much about 50. So first mass gap would be between 2 and 5 solar masses, so between neutron stars and black holes, the supernova engine, if you believe it or not. And the second mass gap would be somewhere between 50, let's put 150 solar masses. Perinstability, here it's you have perinstability supernova here. You try to make it, but gravity wins. Here, what limits is perinstability pulsations that remove envelope, but you still form a black hole.
Are those black hole masses?
Yes.
Or
those are black hole masses, sorry. Yeah, so no, we don't see anything here, and we don't expect much here, and we don't expect anything in that regime. Unless you, let's say you have 250 solar mass black holes merging, that you have 100, and then you catch another one and merge again. But the thing is, when you merge two black holes in global clusters, in those dense environment, most likely already the first merger of, let's say, 1550 is already way outside of clusters because it was already ejected. Let's say it happened in a cluster, the kick from gravitational waves will probably take it out of the system. I wouldn't expect 50 solar mass, I wouldn't expect a black hole in first 100 observations or so. If you look deep enough, long enough, maybe we see one or two. If we see a lot of them, it means probably the perinstability supernovae are not working as we think they are.
Well, do of course now, this all depends, very sensitive to the mass holes, right?
That has nothing to do with mass loss rate. This has only to do with the temperature that you need for perinstability to happen.
But the initial mass, final mass relation, completely dependent on that. So those mass boundaries will also be completely.
No, they are completely independent of mass loss rate. Completely.
These are not initial masses.
They're not initial masses. This is a black hole mass.
Sort of IMF into the beginning of your calculation, right? Yeah.
Yes, sure. But independent of IMF and metallicity, what matters is if a given star core is hot enough in the center to go over 3 × 10⁹ kelvins, you just only worry about that. You don't, whatever winds you want or masses, you just worry about your core to go above that limit. If you're above that limit, you're unstable to percreation. And when you do your pulsation, you eject the envelope, whatever you have left with.
The rates will depend on the rate.
Oh, rates, fine, but I'm not talking about rates. Yes, that, of course, 100% with you on that. Yes.
Sure.
But the limits won't depend on anything.
I disagree with the 50 limit. So the lower limit, if you're just below that limit, you will be in the pulsational parastability regime, and we don't know how much mass you shed there. So I don't know how low that lower limit of 50 will be. I would argue we have uncertainty. I just let me put it provocatively, I wonder if that 50 limit is not closer to the 36 that we were just seeing.
Oh, so if you talk to Stan, it's 42.5. Yes. When you talk to Alex Hager, it's 47.7. And if you talk to Chris, it's 40. Or Chris rounds numbers up, which I like. Chris, you gave me the number as well.
No.
I talked to 3 people to get this number, and I approximated that to 50. Follow the cue.
I don't think they can predict any...
But Stan comes around and claims those numbers.
Yeah.
He was here giving a talk.
Yeah.
So of course nobody believes that, but Alex does the same. It's just 40. It's just 7 here or something. You know, I don't remember. And they, I'm with you on that. Actually, I already heard claims that could be close to the most massive we can get.
Maybe also, we know this, but it's somewhat misleading to put these numbers like this. Of course, we know there's error bars, but it can be any mass ratio between 1 and 0.6, I think, or 0.5.
I think here in that case it's more like 0.7, is it? Right? 2-1.
I thought 0.6 to 1.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. This is a large error bars. Yes. Sure. I don't want to go into those. It's not a LIGO talk. But yeah. But anyway, what I wanted to say, that even within those very basic models, because each of them is very basic, or even hand wavy in some cases, we have set of implications limited by, I'm with you, that's why I will sound as a pessimist. I'm totally with you, with a bunch of number of problem issues that we have, and we'll be improving on them over years, as we were doing for many years. But we don't have any implication from LIGO observations yet, because we don't know where those black holes are coming from. For me, the most actually interesting idea is that those black holes are primordial black holes, because it would be not one Nobel Prize for gravity waves, gravitational waves, but it would be also a Nobel Prize for solving dark matter. Because people claim that you can actually put all the dark matter into black holes in the first minute after Big Bang and hide it in cosmic microwave background. And also, when you put those black holes, primordial black holes, into halos of galaxies, some of them catch each other and merge, and you see them right now. Obvious question is, why didn't you see them as major objects, like Ogle, macro-lensing things, okay? So this is, again, the wrong notion. You can hide them. So that's what I see. So microlensing events can only see black hole mergers up to 15 solar masses, total mass. If you have a more massive merger than 15, the light curve is so long that you're not probing, your experiments are, they don't have a time base long enough. So when you talk to Ogle people, right now, when the Ogle and Macho papers appeared, the mass limit was 10 solar masses. So 5 and 5 solar mass, black hole merger to be excluded. But 10 plus 10, no. None of these could have been excluded. Now they are about to 20 solar masses. So anything above 20 would have escaped them. So all of those would have escaped them. Okay? Now, what's the upper mass limit, what you can have in Halo? You cannot have anything much more massive, total mass, over 100. If you have something more massive than 100, you disrupt white binaries that you see in Halo. Okay? That limit is anywhere between 70 and 150 or so. People debate that because some of the white binaries, we don't know if those are binaries or not, are they in Halo or not, but limit is about 100. So you can hide black holes of total mass between 20 and 100. I haven't put that out on AstroPH yet, but a curious fact is here, that's primordial. So if you actually happen to put all of them, you can have a dark matter. So 2 Nobel Prizes, I would think. That would be it's least likely, but probably most interesting case. I would actually cross out all my channels happily to get this. But it's very hand-wavy. But the actual thing that I calculate, that you can calculate, I calculated that as well, if you tell population 3 binaries, you can actually, 80% of those double black holes for population 3 are in that mass range of total mass 20 to 100. So you could hide almost all population 3 double black holes in Halo and you wouldn't see them.
Making what assumptions about the
IMF? I'll get to that in a... If we do that, if we manage.
Population 3 and primordial is not the same, right?
It's totally different, yes. Yes, totally different, yes. And of course, with population 3, you could only hide a small, tiny bit of fraction of dark matter, about 10 to minus 5 of entire dark matter, because stellar mass in population 3 stars is so small. I'll come back to that point.
And you wouldn't break their nucleus synthesis?
No, no, no. That goes with actually, not to break nucleus synthesis and Planck data, maybe 10 to minus 6. I mean, of dark matter, you could hide in population 3 stars.
In black holes.
In black holes of
the
population 3.
The very intensity in the first minute, right? If you're controlling...
No, that's primordial. You could... No, that's primordial. Population 3 is a different story.
I mean, so making helium and lithium very early after the Big Bang, right, that depends on the baryon density.
That, it's a good question. That I don't know. So there is a couple of review papers that discuss all those consequences of making all of the dark matter through primordial black holes. Just recently, it's about a paper a week on that subject. But it's mostly hand-wavy. I haven't seen that argument. I've just seen them mostly trying to hide them in cosmic microwave background.
But you said it was the first minute?
Yes.
And the first 3 minutes you need for the helium and the beryllium.
So you make the black hole before you get to the nucleus synthesis limit?
I think that's what they want to do with the density fluctuations. I'm not 100% sure. I never worked on that myself. I just read a couple of abstracts and I went through a couple of papers. That's it. But definitely people claim, it's mostly hand-wavy because, of course, you can make those density fluctuations as big as you want. So they claim that, we can be in that regime. Why not? But it's pretty much that sort of argument. Why not? Why we should actually be in that regime, which they say, why not?
But there must be other observational consequences, I suppose. Yeah. So 50-100 solar mass black holes. If they go through the galactic disk in a molecular cloud, they will accrete, you will see X-rays, whatever. There must be many things by which you could detect them.
No. But again, microlensing wouldn't discover them because they would be more massive than 20. And that argument about going from a local cloud, that should work for... So I don't buy their argument. I remember George Grindley already in the 90s trying to look for, if you do IMF in our galaxy, you predict about 10 to the 8 black holes in our galaxy. So people look through X-ray signatures. They haven't found any.
Yeah.
So...
I don't really understand the argument of microlensing. I mean, microlensing was one of the key results that put a limit on being Jupiter's.
Being what?
Being Jupiter, that dark matter was just Jupiter's.
Yes, so it's low mass, yes.
So you're saying that microlensing has an easier time ruling out low mass?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so pretty much when you have a low mass microlensing event, it lasts short time so they can follow a light curve. If you go to high and higher mass, the light curve becomes so stretched out, they don't have a baseline for that. Despite the fact that Ogle is around right now for 20 years. And they're just reaching about 20 solar masses.
And the number density of Jupiter's you need is much higher than the number density of 10 solar masses.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So, how much time we have? 20 minutes. Okay. So let me go very quickly. So, my kind of optimistic point in presenting the population synthesis, it's a presenting optimistic point in a pessimistic way, is the following. That tool, despite all the shortcomings and, having really rudimentary, simple models, can teach you some intuition, or let's say actually can show that your intuition is wrong sometimes. So let me walk you through initial conditions and predictions of black holes. So for many years, and I think Chris and Kobulnitsky papers would probably still show that maybe this is still right, people would use for initial condition for classical binary evolution, they would use initial distribution of orbital periods flat in log. You guys, I'm sure you all remember that. And for eccentricity, people would use something, like thermal distribution, like E rising with the value. So a lot of eccentric systems and a lot of, long orbits, okay? And you do the prediction and you can reproduce all those black holes, okay, to the classical channel. Now Sana et al., Sana and Selma, are coming in 2012, and they say, That doesn't apply to massive stars, and our new distributions are very different. Orbital periods are way shorter. That's a power law. Eccentricities are almost non-existent. All those massive binaries are pretty much on circle orbit. So that's great, because you have closer binaries, a lot of those massive binaries on close orbits. They're going to make a lot of interactions and make you many more double black holes, which you want to get. You do the calculations, which Selma is responsible for, and then you get exactly the same result, exactly the same number in both cases. You're totally insensitive to those initial conditions. So we first thought we've done something wrong. So we go back to verification, we check all the equations, we redo the calculations. We have some students redo the calculations, and we always come up with the same number of black holes within not even a factor of two, within 10%. It just cannot be true. Well, there is a simple reason to that. It is not those initial distributions that matter. What matters is the time of the first contact, whether you have a common envelope of Roche or power flow. What we assume, and it doesn't have to be true, is that that first contact happens, the onset of mass transfer, whether it's stable or unstable, happens when the star, more massive star, goes over its Roche lobe at periastron approach. Okay? So when you combine those distributions and plot the periastron distance, initial periastron distance for those distributions, they are about the same, they're flat. Well, you have that peak here, because you have a lot of closed systems. As it happens, black holes are coming from that regime when both distributions are flat. They give you the same result. You wouldn't guess that just thinking about this. You do the calculation. So this is actually a strength of a population synthesis, to build your intuition and to do some tests, experiments, like you do with MESA. Simpler ones. Even, you know, this is kind of, you know, pessimistic news, because it tells you that you, at least within that one channel, you cannot test initial conditions. And people were making those claims 10, 20 years ago, that maybe LIGO will be testing initial conditions, star formation. No, absolutely not.
So that peak at short periods, that doesn't give you binary black holes, presumably, because they just merge on the main sequence, or what's happening to those systems?
Basically, yes.
Yes. You want them far enough.
So it might give you a black hole, but not a binary black hole.
Yeah. If you're very close, then you switch to here, of course.
You could put them in a triple system.
Yes, 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 yes.
But again, this uses some common envelope wisdom, which has no justification.
And eccentric mass transfer.
It's an experiment.
It's an experiment. We get a better model for common envelope, we put it in, and we redo the...
Then your conclusion may be reversed, you don't know.
It might be, of course, 100% with you on that, yes.
One step more abstract, any model that produces binary black holes from relatively wide initial systems, by whatever mechanism you come up with, is going to be insensitive to this. But it's common envelope or whatever crazy model you have. I think that's the only thing we should... The white part of the period distribution is barely affected by what we did with
it. So with the Kobylnicki study, he actually looked at R-min, R-max, the slope of the orbit, and the eccentricity, and had fits. Is there any of his space that you can rule out, or is it still... I mean, these are just two extremes of,
yes,
of the Kobylnicki.
Yes, and do I get it right, Chris, that you guys are still finding that those could be...
Those are consistent.
Consistent with the observations
down there. So both are consistent.
Both are consistent.
The issue is that if you allow R min and R max also to vary, with a big binary set, you can still get a lot to still fit. I think at least with his pretty big set of binaries, consistent with, you know, all being single B2 binary stars. So he has it. You know, he has those set of parameters. He has a phase space. He made a lot of diagrams of this is allowed.
As Sana et al., they do also have phase space. They can change those, yes. And we haven't tested your Kobylnicki and yours initial conditions. We just assumed those extreme. With Sana et al., we actually changed those. Okay. And the results were insensitive. Just because whatever you do, you get that, you know, kind of nice coverage of the first
contact. That really constrains it. You have none of that parameter space can constrain at all. Is that?
That's my conclusion with the simple physics that we have at the moment, with that common envelope that we have in a moment, and that we assume that once we hit eccentric mass transfer, we circularize to periods from distance. That could be totally untrue for massive stars, let's say, but nobody, I don't know what to do. If somebody tells me what to do, I will do another experiment, and I will, as Norbert says, and I'm with him, I'm not saying it will change, it may completely change.
Maybe to add one caveat to the experiment here, Chris drew the period distribution, eccentricity distribution in two separate diagrams. That means there's the implicit assumption that you can separate these two distributions, and they're actually two dependent distributions.
Very good point, yeah.
Period and eccentricity are not, the eccentricity distribution is different for short period systems than for wide period systems. And then it gets very complicated.
Same with mass ratios, yes.
Same with mass. And some are a bit easy to do, but we don't have enough data points to map that whole process.
But if you were to try to do the periastron distance, could you do that? Would that be better constraint? Because, I mean...
It's just very hard to measure eccentricities well.
Sure.
So if you
if you model it in a statistical way.
If you believe that the fate of a binary is mostly determined by its periastron distance rather than the first two parameters, then, which I think is a relatively reasonable assumption at the state where we are now, then the answer is yes.
So to give you a heads up along those lines, you know, there is Max Moe and his group. They are studying all those correlation between parameters. We took his best model for intercorrelated initial parameters, so mass ratio, orbital period, eccentricity, and IMF, and we ran the simulation, and we thought, okay, now we're gonna get something different. We got exactly the same thing. So we haven't put it out yet. It's one of my students, so he's taking some time, but we got pretty much the same. It's another experiment. We thought we're gonna get something different. No. It seems to be very insensitive to what we do in initial conditions. We're getting the same. But
do you think that maybe it's just because the only system that produce what you want are coming from the same initial conditions, and that set of initial conditions is having the same number in all the distributions? Did you check that?
That is basically what is plot saying.
Yes, that's what it is. I mean, there's nothing really we check, that's what it is.
So that you're just looking at one band.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But of course you can do that in other bands through all the parameters, it comes to the same conclusion. So we actually, it got me, especially that experiment with Max Moe data, got me really annoyed. So I found a case when initial conditions do different. I'm gonna finish with that point, okay? But unfortunately, although that things differ and give you different results, we're not gonna be able to see it. So let's go to population three for a second, okay? So there is a bunch of papers you may have seen, especially Japanese papers, that claim that population three stars that could go under these classical binary channels, just different initial conditions, is that right? And different evolution because no metals. So almost no weak mass loss, let's say. But, you know, people followed that evolution in an approximate way. And some groups arrived, and I'm included in that bunch as well, with my old papers, we concluded that, you know, those population three stars, because they could be so much more massive, initial conditions could be different, that they will produce a lot of dark black holes that LIGO could see. Actually, maybe even some of those are already population three black holes. So, but it was all done wrong. So, what people assumed in all the calculations that I've seen so far was this. Not even SANA at all, initial distributions, but those initial distributions, okay, for population three stars. And let's just forget about orbit or so, but let's go into IMF, because it will make much clearer. I will show you how IMF for population three stars should look like, okay? So typical IMF so that's POP1, 2, we all agree it's a power law, is that right, with some alpha. And that alpha would be, we will argue about this, somewhere between 2 and 3, okay? If you draw that on a plot here, that would look like this. It's only log here, not log here, so it's not a straight line. But it would drop steeply with mass, okay? Without arguing for this. Now, when you want to do population 3, that's what it does. Yes, I know you're shaking your head. I would be shaking my head as well. So, how do you arrive at that IMF for population three stars? That's the first one. I believe it's derived self-consistently and physically. So, you take a bunch of dark matter halos from cosmological simulations, okay? You put some gas density here. What was the gas density that we used? You put some gas, each dark matter halo formed from fuel to about 10 stars. So let's say you do a simulation with about 5 stars. So you put, you form 5, let's say, pop-free stars. They're all single, or mostly single, okay? And now you evolve dynamically those 5 stars. Pop-free stars within the dark matter halo at high redshift. It happens. By the way, when you have, this is taken from paper of Stace and Broom, 2013. So state of art dark matter halo. That IMF of those single stars follows power law, but with index flat. But it's still a power law. Okay. So you have a power law of single pop-free stars. Wait a second. Now, you let those stars evolve dynamically with gas, and they catch and form binaries. And it tends to act that way, that usually the most massive star catches a companion, or not catches anything. So some dark matter halos will not form even a single binary, but some will form. And you tend to put the most massive star that you have formed in a binary. That's why it increases with mass. Okay? So now this is, so your initial parameters are totally different than what you use for POP1 and POP2 when you form stars in a big assembles. Here you just have a few stars per dark matter halo. So separations are different, IMF is different, everything is different, not only evolution. So this actually gives you a boost in a black hole formation. That increases your black hole formation by order of magnitude. Okay? So you expect that you're okay. Now you're going to produce a lot of double black holes from population 3. But that's not right. You don't have enough stars in population 3, and they have short delay times. And that kills you so much that your rates are 4 orders of magnitude or 3 orders of magnitude in merger rates at the current time below all those channels. Okay? So when you actually do calculate how much stars is in population 3 compared to population 1, so when you look at the Madoff plot, so that would be star formation rate, log scale, solar masses per megaparsec cube per year, that would be redshift. So population 1 and 2 would do something like this. Maybe max would be at redshift 2, that's redshift 0, end up somewhere around redshift 15. That's very kind of uncertain, okay? Madoff plot. That's about 10 to minus 1. That's about 10 to minus 2, 10 to minus 3 solar masses per megaparsec cube per year. When you plot population 3, it will look something like this. So now the peak is at around 10 or 15, somewhere around 10, 15. It stops somewhere around 2, but maybe much earlier. I'm already making it kind of very optimistic. I'm trying to pump here a lot of stars. And we'll end up at around redshift of 40. Now, when you integrate those curves in such a way that you ask a question, how many of those stars could contribute to black holes coming, when they merge, coming along the light cone to us, to LIGO instrument? The mass you get here, where do I have those numbers? Here it's 3 times 10 to, well, I need to find these numbers. Will you give me a sec? Don't to make put you in a. Ten to 20 solar masses, and here you have 3 times 10 to 18 solar masses. So this is 1%. This is 99%. So it's 2 orders of magnitude difference. Even if those stars are producing black holes order of magnitude at more efficient way, they will give you less black holes that can merge. And then most of those black holes, delay time falls off like T2 minus 2 or T2 minus 1. That's a delay time. So that's number, log number, and that's delay. And you start at about, you know, delay time is about a few hundred mega year, all the way to over Hubble time. So that's about, let's say, 10 gigayears. And you need to wait 10 gigayears for those stars to make it to LIGO band. So you're only probing the end of distribution, stiff distribution. So there's no way you could actually, that population 3 stars, black holes, could dominate that thing.
So we how do you know the delay time so well?
Oh, that comes from, okay. So that comes from a simple argument. You do that thing to get initial distribution, or you can actually vary the initial distribution from, you know, flat to some power law, up or down. And then you have Peters equations, merger time. So merger times is proportional.
Sure.
Yeah, and then you follow that argument. And that gives you that power law.
No, that's not the center.
Yeah. Initial, so we actually have an estimate of initial distributions from dynamical simulations of dark matter halos. But if you apply any n of those, that delay time distribution doesn't change as much. Order of magnitude up or down, but it's still a steep power law. It's more like T2 minus 2, not T2 minus 1.
So without wishing to imply that I believe the predictions for the IMF and population 3, if that was true, would the parent stability supernova rate be interesting in those halos, or even the ionization from these very massive stars? I mean, you have a significant population above your mass gap, right? So you're putting a lot of energy in from explosions.
No. Yes. So some of them, yes, would be exploding. Yes. But you don't change the number of stars. It just, this is, because, so no. So your IMF, your real IMF is this. So it's steeper power law, but, well, it's, so your so those are binary, pop three. That would be your single stars. Or so overall, because this is only subpopulation, what you draw from that. So you want to look at this. You look at the parallel IMF just with a shallower exponent.
So this is something
to make that, estimates.
Yeah, this is something that like JWST can actually will answer. If there's lots of parent stable supernova, the cosmologists would have gotten something right for once. But but you know, I think this is, you know, this is because we've been working on what's a IMF, and I think you're not, like, that's a pretty, 0.17 is fairly, that's as good as the 41.2 from Stan.
Yeah. But, you know, you just adopt a model. It's again, not putting you to actual numbers, but I wanted to walk you through the logic. But you don't want to talk to cosmologists or, you know, get that number or some IMF that they give you and apply this in population synthesis. You need to put it in the context. You need to put those stars that they make, and you need to see what binaries you form. And the binaries you form are very different. So I'm not claiming that it's exactly the shape, but you will come, and there's a physical rationale behind it, you come with something very opposite, because the most massive star will try to catch the companion.
So your message is don't trust cosmologists, think for yourself.
No. Just be careful when you're setting your simulation, your experiment. Okay? That when you're given something for, IMF of pop 3 stars, you cannot blindly apply it to your binary simulations. Okay? That's a different...
If you plot it. IMF for binary stars.
But nobody done it. But nobody
even a population one, right? It wouldn't be the same as IMF like single stars.
Well, we don't really have single massive stars. We have.
IMF for population one stars is different to the IMF for population one binary stars. Because there's a binary.
Yeah, but we're already having that in mind, and we're taking for pop one and pop two simulation experiments. We adopt those binary stars. And nobody has done it yet for POP3, and they're getting huge numbers of, since they use wrong assumptions, and they do something wrong with putting those experiments in the cosmological context. They do something wrong here, like I just showed you. They get also that type of delay time distribution. That number of stars, I probably exaggerated by order of magnitude. It probably should be 10 to 17. This curve that I gave you, that number that I integrated, is about 10 times higher than what Planck allows for POP3 for reionization. But I wanted to be very optimistic for POP3. I wanted to just ask a question. Is this really possible that those people claiming that most of black holes could come from POP3? No. So when you do actually, that's my last sentence, when you do actual LIGO prediction, full advanced sensitivity, you observe for 1 year with a duty cycle of about 30%. So you're observing about 150 days in full advanced LIGO sensitivity, let's say in 5 years. You will see about 100 to 1,000 of black holes at least coming from those predictions. And you will see one or two of those.
In
that optimistic case, one or two. And the masses will be about the same. Mass distributions are slightly different. But if you have one or two buried in a hundreds of those, you will not know. So again, I would caution you about those kind of optimistic gung-ho papers, population synthesis papers, claiming that we'll learn a lot about early universe and pop three stars from like observations. I don't believe that. At least I don't trust that case. Okay, I'll stop here.
So I think we have half an hour for questions. I saw Ed's hand first.
Can you say something about the ratio between the first two, the predictions of the first two?
Those first two? Selma, you want to make the case? well, because I will be pushing for my channel. Let her make the case.
I'm not gonna.
Okay, so
the homogeneous channel, if you for the lower mass events, I don't know how to do that with homogeneous evolution at the moment. I pushed Mesa to do pretty crazy mixing to make 20 solar mass stars also mix, but if I do that, I completely mess up things like an under diagram.
But you can very easily, nicely do that. This is not a problem at all. Yeah.
No. And then the rates?
The rates? Well, I can quote the rates if you want, but they
both
get
both are consistent with what is
the curve within the universe. So they get rates of about 100 to 200. My rates are from low black hole kicks. I get 220 for my standard model, and for if I give all the black holes neutron star kicks, like full neutron star kicks, like from Hobbes distribution with sigma 265 kilometers per second, my rate drops down to 7, just below. Well, doesn't. So I pretty much, with black hole kicks, I span entire range.
But why would there be such large kicks? Is there any...
Why wouldn't... Yes, why wouldn't be a kick? Why don't you answer me that question?
Well, with neutron stars, we know that there is all this... funny things happening, but I don't know what happens when you collapse.
Yes, I don't know either, so I wouldn't be able to claim that there is no kicks. Let's say you have asymmetric neutrino emission, and you get a big kick.
From the neutrinos down to the black hole?
No, definitely not. So that's actually, that's a question. How many neutrinos, Chris, would you like to comment on that? We're talking about black hole neutrino kicks now. So is it still a valid option or not?
So before it forms a black hole, it forms it has this proto-neutron star. And so the kick mechanisms that you have, the neutrino-driven kick mechanism you have with the proto-neutron star still there, the momentum...
Well, it's only a tiny fraction of what later is going to be the black hole.
You're unlikely to get... You can get a kick that's the momentum of the neutrino-driven, what you would expect out of a neutron star. It would be the momentum, and so you'd expect the black hole kick that was less by the ratio of the mass of the neutron star and the mass of the black hole.
Yeah, so then it will go down by quite a large factor.
Yeah, you're not going to probably get 450 kilometer per second kicks, but you can get...
I remember that Philip had this one black hole with a large kick, I think, in a low mass. But how massive is that black hole?
Well, at birth, I would say 4.5 solar masses.
Okay.
And there's a kick of 100 kilometers.
Okay, yeah, but that would fit then with...
Yeah,
with
that's consistent.
Yeah.
But as soon as you get to 30 solar masses, I would think that the kick would disappear almost.
Let's say from via fallback. And you can have this tugboat mechanism before there is complete fallback that could give a kick in principle.
Yeah, so unfortunately right now I have models with no kicks and full kicks, and they exactly span that range. So I cannot, LIGO, I'm sure we have two or three more detections during O2 right now. I know people are writing papers up as we speak here. LIGO is writing papers, so we should see them soon. And LIGO people hope to narrow down the range. Again, those conclusions will be limited within a model, simplifications that we have, and only, it will still be only valid within the, we would need to cover entire parameter space to see, that, let's say I can give a, I can rule out a large kick in few models, but then I would have to sample entire parameter space to see if there is maybe a full kick, but other thing. Increasing the rates. I could increase the rates.
Yeah, I want to make one more statement on uncertain physics and the rates which you produce. So if you say 9 to 240, I think...
That's a LIGO estimate.
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So my rates are similar. My rates are very similar spanning, but what's on the blackboard, it's a LIGO estimate.
Okay, but your rates are...
also having an upper and lower limit which are similar. So you talk a lot about LVVs here, and you know, if all stars above 40 become LVVs, which I don't know whether they do or not, but you know, it's a possibility, and then their envelope floats off even without a companion, mm-hmm. then this blue period range which you from which you extract your black hole binaries would perhaps not produce any. Yeah?
Why not?
Because
well, I remove envelopes from those binaries from those stars anyway.
But then it happens by itself. It doesn't need a companion, and so you would not shrink your orbit.
But
you assume the LVV phase, which is I think not what Nathan was saying, but if you assume it's not because of binaries,
okay.
then maybe you can make a constraint on how many black holes, because you now don't have that, you know, now I don't have that common envelope phase because I'm ejecting everything without the help of the binary.
Are you saying that you would like to eject envelope very early in the evolution, before stars leave main sequence?
Before they become red supercharged.
Yeah, but did not Nathan just...
Then yes, show? That would total, yes, okay. Okay.
So if we have this uncertainty, you're right, Nathan says this and that, maybe it's not the case, but it's an uncertainty.
Yes, of course.
If you fold that in, then you...
When the rate is zero.
The rate could become zero.
Yes, I fully agree with you.
And so I'm wondering, you know, what your error bar on the rate.
So I told you I don't have error bar because I only imagine this is the entire parameter space, I only check that much of the parameter space. So my error bar is right now from about 1 to 500. So I go above those limits, I limited those models. But that error bar is limited to the really tiny part of parameter space that I checked.
And you also honestly said during your talk that you don't really know which channel the observed system.
No, we don't. Yeah, so I fully agree with you. It could be if you include those,
but
zero.
But you say that earlier that the error bars which you produce for the rate is within a factor of 10 or so. I think the true error bar on these very massive population synthesis outcomes is.
Okay, I was.
Both of you agree here, right? So.
Yeah. Okay. So no, but okay. So no. He's right. I said that those errors that I'm giving you, this order or order of magnitude, are within the parameter space that we checked. If we include all those, I take it back. You're right. Then it goes to infinity. I mean, it can go down to zero. If I include those effects, yes. But I haven't checked those. Like I said, I only did a small parameter space, and within that small parameter space. It's 1 to 2 orders of magnitude.
So you're short. I caught you for infinite error buses.
No. That's fine.
Not on the upward part, I presume.
But I don't consider them my errors. Those are errors that we have in stellar astrophysics. It's not my. It's our community errors or uncertainties that we just fold into experiments and we're trying to do. Let's say somebody wants a quick intuition. You know what those new observations or potential new conclusions are going to change. For evolution. Bam, here you have a tool to do it. Let's say somebody, we still don't know what makes supernovae 1A, what type of white dwarfs, what type of accretion. So, you know, you come up with your new favorite model of accretion onto sub-Chandrasekhar mass white dwarf, and you need a kind of sanity check if that channel is getting you even in a ballpark of a supernovae 1A rate, or you 5 orders of magnitude off. So that's a tool to use with. But no, I think I'll have to take back that 1 or 2 orders of magnitude out the way you pointed it out. Yes, I agree. If you include effects like this, I would go down to zero. I need common envelope in all those scenarios.
And I think when you call this, it's mostly you vary assumptions one by one, not necessarily everything at the same time of the one.
Yes, exactly. So exactly that I'm saying. I'm only probing like I have a standard model and I change one assumption.
This must be because in the paper you plot there the IMF, you didn't plot it, but that is a factor 8 already.
Yes.
So that would multiply the other.
So by full parameter space, I mean checking all the degeneracies between parameters. So we haven't done that study, and we're starting to do that. Ilya is doing that, and I'm doing that in different ways. But we're just starting to do it, scratching the surface. And then, like models, new common envelope, or maybe LBVs like that, need to be added to
But the question is the real physics within the parameter space that you have?
Most likely not. No, we're not there yet. I mean, we cannot be there yet because we have so many problems with stellar, even atomic physics. Is that right? Frank Timmis was telling us about atomic physics, then stellar evolution, and only I get that from all of you guys, that information, and put it into my simplistic models. So we're not there yet, and we won't be there for
a
long time.
You have your program, your whole population synthesis program. Now we have, if you just go now to the somewhat lower masses, and we have 15 double neutron stars,
mm-hmm.
Can your population synthesis program produce...
Reproduce both rates, yes. I can reproduce both short GRB rates if they come from...
No, not the GRB. I just want to see the 15 double neutron stars we have nowadays. Can you
I can reproduce those masses and the rates.
And then
one, I'm on a low side.
Yeah, on the low side.
Mm-hmm. But yes, I can do reproduce those.
Well, and then I would say, if that works, making double neutron stars or double black holes, it is just an analogy to the higher going to the higher masses.
But a lot of people don't agree with that.
It does not completely change. No. It changes gradually when you go to higher.
No, but it will be on the classical binary channel, and also, I mean, even like the thing which stops them to produce a closed black hole binaries, like for example, having a mass transfer during the Hertzsprung gap, it's just inapplicable to those which produce double neutron stars. I mean, there are things which completely work differently in more massive stars. But also the question is whether he can produce
Why does it suddenly change?
The LBV range? LBV, peristabilis to supernova, it's a lot of
different things. These are a totally different piece than we had thought before. So maybe it just...
But we don't see the stars. We don't see the red supergiants.
Okay. But can you still... to make the double neutron stars, you probably have to go not higher than 20 solar masses.
No.
But suppose you go now to 30 solar masses, you would already produce small black holes, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I will.
30 solar masses with early case B
masses. Oh, no. If I include case A, I can go to 100 solar masses and produce neutron stars. But typically it's below 20 solar masses with neutron stars. 10, 11-ish, 15-ish, you know. But yes, I can go to 100.
But let's go gradually to a little bit higher. So that you just make little black holes. I mean,
that's what we do. And I'm not sure if what you're saying is true, but I'm doing what you're saying. We kind of gradually build up, but, you know, there are things, like Natasha was saying, that same things, you sometimes hit a wall, like, let's say, peristability supernova wall, that your things change.
That's much higher,
yes, but then you think, you know, some kind of issues with mass transfer on development of instability on Hertzsprung gap during mass transfer. For massive stars, it's different than for low mass stars, and it happens around 20 solar masses.
When you say low mass stars, it means 20 solar.
Yes, I mean low mass stars, that's a neutron star progenitor, high mass stars, black hole progenitor, in that sense. So you
is
do...
Is it so dramatic that this...
Natasha, I mean, you need to comment
on that. It is very different. The stability of a mass transfer during, what he calls as a Hertzsprung gap, but basically when you cross the diagram, it's very different.
You're the corpus burning,
low mass stars.
So, you know, I wish it was that simple, but so we actually do have some of those walls included in those calculations.
Yeah, I remember.
Whether that's true or not.
But also out of curiosity, so when you reproduce the galactic population of double neutron stars, could you reproduce it only with one set of assumptions, or you can use several different sets of assumptions that will all produce some population which will resemble the galactic population of double neutron stars? Can you have any constraints from...
Yes, so it seems no matter what I do with assumption within that simple model, I'm getting about the same numbers of and masses of those neutron stars. And those are pretty low. So it's very... So I really have one student to ignore me and ignore my physics and actually read papers, some of you guys here in that room. So one student is to ignore me and try to tweak all those initial conditions, evolutionary assumptions, to either kill those neutron stars or bring them higher up, because we had a low, you know... And it seems to be that amount of neutron stars that we're getting, producing the merger rates, are kind of insensitive to what we do.
Anyway.
I quote Thomas Taubes here, it's not my wisdom, but he says that case BB mass transfer is extremely important.
Case BB?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And If he says you don't include that?
I included that 15 years ago. When Jacinta Dewey and Thomas were doing those papers, I had that mass transfer already then, back then. So yes, we do have that. And you guys write a lot of those papers and compact supernovae things, very low mass going off at close orbit. We had those 15 years ago.
I think you guys should talk. I think he thinks that is a very important...
Yes, it is very important thing. It brings things together and we have that effect and our rates are still low. We do have that.
So can you tell me about spin? What are the predictions about spin rates from classical binary channel, and how do you calculate those?
Yeah, so I don't calculate spins per se, so I don't for angular momentum of stars, I don't have rotating models of stars. What I do, what I can do, once I form a black hole, I just say whatever initial, so my initial spin of a black hole is a free parameter, 0.5 or say 0.99, okay? Or you can choose any value. But then I have accretion, good, I think, kind of reliable accretion models, the best we can get from Andrew King, Jean-Pierre Lasotte. I was meeting here a few weeks ago on a similar issue. So I have accretion models onto black hole, and I can check how much mass I accrete onto the newly formed black hole. So to spin up a black hole significantly, you need to accrete about as much mass as black hole weighs. It never happens in those binaries that leads to the formation of double black holes, because those are very high mass stars. So you form one black hole. When you go through common envelope, you accrete at maybe 10% Bondi Hoyle. Paul Ricker, you know, Ron Tam, Enrico Ramirez, Lewis, MacLeod, 10%. So you get maybe on a 30 solar mass black hole, you get about one solar mass, maybe two. It's not enough. In a steady Rorschach overflow, when you have a very massive companion, you way over Eddington limit, so you lose a lot of mass initially, and then you accrete, but again, not more than one or two solar masses. So I think if LIGO will measure the spins, those spins will be initial spins. Against what Tassos is claiming. Totally against what his conclusions in, it is a Fragos and McClintock paper. But they did a very, I think, bad thing. They let all the mass from a star to go onto a black hole with no limits. On that. This is not, this well, doesn't, I don't think this happens.
Limited, wasn't it?
Well, no, it was not. No, 100%. So, yeah, 100%. So they did extreme, and this is fine. This is an upper limit. But when you do actually Andrew King model or Lasota models or Oshuga or Sandowski, Narayan, kind of limited black hole accretion, even if you crank it up, you cannot spin those black holes up significantly, not more than, you know, a few percent.
Okay, there's another way to spin up black holes, which is you go through a common envelope and then maybe you have a Wolf-Rey black hole system.
Okay.
Okay. Then you can tidally spin up the Wolf-Rey star depending on the orbital period of that system. And then if that collapses, people have shown it should give you a pretty rapidly rotating black hole.
Sure, but you still be it still be initial.
But this is all dependent on outcome of the common envelope, right? So this is something that I think you could, in principle, predict.
But you do see, no, yes, but you.
How many of those rapidly rotating black holes you get from that common operation.
But you do see those three systems that have a massive Wolf-Rey star and a very nearby compact object. So it's
six.
Six, okay, see, exactly. So you don't know what the companion is. I mean, what the accretor is, yes, but you do.
They are black holes.
Black, yeah, I would agree with you, yes, I know. I would, yes. But, you know, you do have, and orbital periods are like 0 1 day, so if you believe tides, I mean, you. And if I effective enough, yes, that's a, so second black hole should be spinning rapidly then.
So you have to get the angular momentum into the core, right, and not have it get out.
Yeah, but that's fine. You just need to put angular momentum into the Wolf-Rey star.
But, okay, so, I mean, I know, Ed, you guys looked at this.
The collapses with the black
this,
hole, which is
this was for really tight binaries, you can get a spin up.
Yeah,
what fraction of black holes can you do that to?
So I don't know. That depends on where you exit.
But these are the ones that will later merge, right?
Yeah, exactly. Those are the ones that merge.
Okay, so, yeah. So those that merge at the stage, so the limit is you have to be below orbital separation, below 50 solar radii, 50, Wolf-Rey star and your compact object to make a merging binary. So you take that as number, so anywhere between 10 and 50. If you're too close, you already something is going wrong. In at least in classical channel, but between 10 and 50. So you can go and work your whatever tight model.
50 is big. 50 solar radii is big, right? You were looking at orbital periods that were more like
on what are they?
One day
periods.
One day is more like 10 solar radii, right? Yeah.
It has to be more like a year. So,
and we do have some of it with 10 solar radii. Yeah.
Plus than a year, because your objects are massive. But.
Well.
Yeah, I agree. It's only the tighter ones that will get spun up at tides.
But that may get a chance to get spin up. You don't know how those tides are really operating.
Sickness explains again.
That's true, but the tides are really a strong function of semi-major axis, so you can actually predict fairly reliably that the really close ones get spun up and the far ones don't spin up, regardless of what your tidal Q is.
Okay.
We did a detailed study of that a few years ago with Philip, and what we found is that the Wolfrayet winds can easily mess up.
Remove?
Either they widen the system or through spin-off coupling, they lead to a merger already very early.
But there's one strong assumption in that Dantner's paper, right? So you always start with a zero HMN sequence helium star. Mm-hmm. So some of the population will already have burned some of its helium, so the winds will have less chance to widen the system.
It's like a case. If you do it through case C or so, then you don't have the time scale. Then you don't have the time anymore.
Some assumptions you get expansion during Cohelion bang, right? So you could have these things start with YC of 0.2 or 0.1. Right? So some of the population will have chance to be spun up and not spun down again, and not to be widened by the waves.
The observed period change in sigma X3 does not show any increase. I think it even shows a decrease.
It's increasing.
Anyhow, it's a tiny.
Time scale 10 to 7 years, I think.
You're trying to do this at 1/10 solar metallicity, mostly, at least. All your rates are dominated by waves of solar metallicity, and if the Wolfrayet winds would go down there, then you don't have to worry about the widening of the
orbit. It depends on which masses you want to produce.
Yeah, but even those low masses are most likely coming from low metallicity if you do classical channel. Even for low masses, you need low metallicity.
So I think Andre has been kind of patient in putting his hand up and getting into it.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I just have a quick. So, like, the end of this process is the Peters formula that you wrote there, and it has very strong dependence on the semi-major axis. So it seems that any uncertainty in previous evolution will get greatly amplified by this equation. So my question is, what kind of precision on the final A you need to, you know, get rates within factor of 2, and whether that can ever be achieved?
So, like I said, it's really a last common envelope that sets. We don't have a model, but yeah, that means, you know, if I common envelope can pull binaries from different, you know, initial separations, and you always end up with a group having separations in the right regime. So let's say below 50 solar, separation below 50 solar radii.
Okay.
Most people don't believe that common envelope model, but I think if we think that common envelope works at all for massive stars and it tightens the binaries, as we think it does, having such a wide range of initial separations, you will end up always with SEM with the right, you know, range to produce merging binaries. It's just like you just need, you know, you just need to end up with something on orbit shorter than, you know, 40, 50 solar radii. That's it, and then all of them will merge within Hubble time. I don't know if I answered your question. I'm not sure if I fully follow that.
So this plot, that's not the initial conditions, right? The number versus period. Right? Because then it should depend on initial conditions quite strongly. Whether you get enough centrifugal binaries that are close enough.
Okay.
I think Chris's point is you have a wide range of initial.
Yes. Even if you are slightly less or slightly more, you still have enough to fit within the range with reasonable models.
I think his claim is the initial phase space that makes the mergers moves around, but you still get the right density of phase space to get the right rates.
Yeah,
within this range. So my question was whether you can learn about all of this that you get the rate within factor of 2.
you cannot, that's my point, you cannot learn anything really because this is, your rates are not changing by much.
So you cannot learn about the initial conditions from where you came from.
Yes.
Well, all we learn is that the universe makes binaries within that range.
Yes.
If his model is correct, if...
Yes.
Okay, unless there's an urgent question.
Well, I still would like to point also at the cluster global cluster dynamics. We know from the double neutron stars that there are two out of the 15 are in globular clusters. So we know that works also.
Yes, if we retain black holes, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we still are wondering how many black holes are retained. That's unlike the neutron stars, which are easily to detect in global clusters compared to black holes. It's an open question about how many black holes are retained.
Yeah, of course. So, but we know in any
you cannot make extrapolation from the case of neutron stars towards black holes, even for global clusters.
Yeah, because you don't see the black holes. But that's the big problem. Yeah. They have no hair, which you can see.
From the fact that you see two, can you? Is this enough to estimate? You know what you could expect from them in terms of black hole mergers.
From the initial mass function, you would expect black holes to be produced in globular, have been produced in globular clusters, of course, at some point, at the very beginning. And what I remember from these simulations by Pete Hurt and Shri Kulkarni is that, of course, they sink to the center. They find each other, but you need three or more body interaction, and they are kicked out of the cluster as far as I
And they merge outside of the cluster, yeah.
So how sure are we that these black holes are formed in these clusters? Because the simulations that do that, they use these very type of prescriptions that extrapolate stellar evolutionary models that were computed by Arnold Pauls up to 50 solar masses. And so all these black holes, I mean, the Nemecol story, all the worries that Norbert is raising still holds for these black holes. I'm not so sure we actually have black holes for. It's a super dense environment. You're trying to swell up. If LBBs are not giving you trouble, there's other stars.
Oh, you mean that the envelopes are taken away from them by dynamical interaction?
No, they're black hole candidates, but the things that, I mean, it's still, there's several layers of pools
when you look long enough.
And then they turn out to pools when you look long enough. Some of them didn't classify it as CVs before, right? So I mean,
yeah, magnetic CVs.
I don't think it's a given that clusters can have massive black holes inside them, and you know, for massive, it's very hard to prove, but still it must.
Of course, in the central parts, you have these problems where you can get the envelope open. But suppose that you have massive stars which are further out. Why wouldn't they become a black hole? I just can't see.
Imagine they became black hole, but you give each black hole a 50 kilometers per second kick, and you remove all black holes from regular clusters, all of them, and they don't sink together. And you cannot exclude 50 kilometers per second kicks for those black holes.
On the outside, you leave with 10 kilometers a second, right?
That's nowadays, but I don't know how it was.
Yeah, I mean, with neutron stars, you saw it through electron capture supernova.
Right?
Yeah, but it doesn't apply for black holes. Yeah. So I'm almost wondering if we go about this all wrong, in the sense we're trying to start from initial conditions, which are, I'm guilty of that as well. But so it's just fascinating. It's a super simple thing. We need two massive objects within a radius of 10 to 50 solar radii. I mean, it's super well constrained, and that's the whole. So now we can go out and make how we got there. But we're folding so much physics in that we don't know. I'm not sure where I'm going with this comment, but it's such a helpful strange thing.
It's being recorded, remember?
The backwards calculation is also really painful, so, I mean, you know, life just sucks.
On that happy note, let's go to lunch.